Stephen.
Hello, Stephen, and belated happy Thanksgiving to you.
And to you, too. I hope you had a good one.
I did. We took a break last week. It was kind of, we took an early Thanksgiving break last week, and we're back again this week. We figured that, you know, everybody takes Thanksgiving break on Thanksgiving, and that just means that there's nobody at their post. And so we decided we would take Thanksgiving early so that we could be aware of any news that was changing that people needed to be informed of. And that was just a whole lot of malarkey.
Yeah, well, and you know, these days too, I mean, you blink and you miss about 17 news items. So when we were off last week, Trump didn't have, then did have, and now doesn't have COVID anymore. And now he's completely immune to everything, like Superman. He can do whatever he wants and he'll never be sick again.
You know what? When he did that whole theatrical business about returning to the White House, and then when he took the mask off his face, I said to Leanna, he's doing it with the same theatricality of Clark Kent pulling his shirt open when he shows the Superman emblem in the movies. And sure enough, it comes out later that that's what it was a proxy for, because he wanted to come out of the hospital and pull his shirt open with a Superman logo on it. And I just bet Warner Brothers would be thrilled with that.
Oh, you can't buy that kind of advertising.
Yeah, you can't get rid of it either. No. You can't fix the spin on it either.
Well, I'm just picturing him in like a T, I mean, maybe the top button or something, but him pulling off a shirt and seeing a bulging t-shirt underneath is not exactly like Superman will really have let himself go if that's kind of the way you think he looks.
Yeah, it's sort of he'd be more like a Superman water balloon than anything else. But yes, the news happens and 17 things happen before you turn around, and you know what, your understanding of the world hasn't changed having missed those 17 news items. That's the thing, news moves at such a fast clip. But because, I don't know if it's because things move at such a fast clip or because they really make a big deal out of things that are not consequential, that we wind up, the world hasn't shifted because of those 17 news items. The world is just, it's the same as it was before we tuned out. Things are fundamentally the same, and they haven't even rearranged the deck chairs. They're just even maybe just eyeing the deck chairs, but stuff happens that we consider news, which doesn't really fundamentally change our world or our understanding of the world. It's just, there's a difference between news and information.
It's just a bunch of more stuff is what it's been.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're choking on information, but we're starved for actual news and context and you know, some kind of commentary that helps to contextualize the news. We get tons of information, but most of us don't have the type of filter that's able to pull the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, and so, to process it all. I mean, there's so much to process now. You know, it's firing on all cylinders. And this is the way the Trump presidency has been from the beginning. I mean, and it's just, you know, well, you know, it's now on meth. It's going so fast because at the beginning it was, you know, a scandal about every couple of days, which was unheard of because, you know, presidents, you know, Obama went through his presidency with nary a scandal. Clinton had one or two of more famous scandals over his 8 years. But the Trump administration has been one thing after another. It's been people going to jail. It's been people writing tell-all books. It's been porn stars. It's been rape accusations. There's just been, you know, Russian gangster loans. I mean, it's stuff you, if you wrote this down and tried to sell it to one of the networks as a series, they'd go like, you know, this is just not believable.
Well, that would have been their reaction about 5 years ago. Oh, now they would say, no, people don't want to see any more of that.
Yeah. So, but this has been sort of Trump's thing, which is lurching from major scandal, major development, you know, life-threatening situation to another, and you never catch your breath. You are always, you know, like, well, just look at the last couple of weeks. I mean, we found, you know, Trump had his, he got COVID, then he didn't get COVID. He had his tax returns leaked and showed that he was over $400 million in debt to somebody, probably Russian oligarchs. There's been a whole bunch of things that have happened, and you can barely remember what happened 3 days ago because there's been so much stuff in between. And someone once suggested that was basically the policy of the Trump government, which is to keep you constantly on your balance. Your outrage never really focuses on one thing because there's six new things and people have forgotten that terrible thing that happened last Tuesday.
Well, yeah, and it makes you numb. It makes you real. It makes you feel that this is just normal. This is the new normal. So you have, I mean, his brand is one of corruption and illegal activity around surrounding him. And so that's his brand. And he gets a pass amongst a lot of people because, oh, well, that's Trump's brand. He's established it. And people have allowed him to skate. Meanwhile, Biden has to watch everything, dot every I, cross every T perfectly, because his brand doesn't include that level of ineptitude and narcissism and corruption. So people, the expectations people have for each candidate are very, very different. And Biden is, in some respects, up on a pedestal in the sense that he's got a long way to fall, whereas Trump's already on the ground. You know, he's underground, he's subterranean, and that's his domain. So Trump has an advantage in that way, in that he can say and do any outrageous, stupid thing. And people at this point, they half shrug it off because you can't, your outrage meter reaches oversaturation, and then you can no longer feel the same outrage anymore. It just becomes another day. Yeah. And, you know, a lot, there are people who wonder, what is the effect of a U.S. election on Canada? I've had people, read people on Twitter saying, why should we care as Canadians who the U.S. president is? And there are so many reasons, not the least of which is that they're our largest trading partner. And we saw what happened when they decided to flex their muscles and use a national security clause to put tariffs on our aluminum. It's a mutually assured destruction thing in that U.S. supply chains need the stuff they get from Canada. Canada needs the business it gets from the U.S. And the U.S. can't really go it alone and just go all, you know, America first, America only, because they need what we offer here. But in your view, what are some of the ways in which the outcome of the U.S. election affects us here?
I think it affects us in ways that are just that are really big and also very subtle. I mean, some of the big ways is just sort of our general attitude towards things. A lot of people look at the way Canadians consume news, and we're pretty big news consumers. I mean, we still have newspapers. Social media is becoming more and more important as a source of news, but Canadians still watch the news. And we watch it from a different points of view too. I mean, there was one point I was getting like three different newspapers and, watching the evening news and in addition to social media and that kind of thing. And Canadians generally are slightly more sophisticated and omnivorous consumers of news than Americans. So we tend to be a little better informed, but all the stuff in the United States, I mean, it's like trying to study for an exam while someone's playing the tuba next door. There's it's like, no matter how hard you're trying to concentrate, there's this noise coming from the other side of this thin wall, which is American politics. So while we try to do our stuff, we try to be our own people. It's really, really hard to ignore the stuff going on in the United States. I mean, you and I in our podcast, we talk about the Americans an awful lot. And, I'd love to talk about Canadian politics, but at the moment, Canadian politics is fairly dry. I mean, we got through what was being touted as a constitutional crisis, involving the governor general and whether or not there's going to be a confidence vote in a minority government, which usually is fairly exciting stuff in Canada. But that kind of passed without too much notice. I mean, we got through it. Trudeau survived a confidence motion supported by the NDP. The throne speech passed, looks like an economic statement, and the CERB 2 has passed. It's not very exciting. I mean, we got lots of problems and things to deal with here, lots of COVID related and economic stuff, but the United States just has so much theater and excitement and venality that just Canadians can't help but watch. It's like rubbernecking on the highway if there's an accident. I mean, we can't pry our eyes off it. And that's got to affect us. I mean, I think it affects us in our discourse, in the way we look at institutions. I mean, it gets under our skin in a certain way, in the cynicism that we see in the United States, although it's not applicable to Canada by and large. It is still something that I think diminishes some of our institutions, you know, at least the public's respect for them, because we're wrongly saying this is the way government is. It's like, no, that's the way American government is. Canadian government certainly has its issues, but you know, politics is done very differently up here, even though, you know, the Conservative Party notably want to do politics the way the American Republicans want to do politics. I mean, you can see that, you know, O'Toole's meme machine, his slogans and things. I mean, they're these corny 1950s. It's sort of make Canada great again kind of things. If you follow them on Facebook and other places, you know, they're anti-China rhetoric. Yeah, China is a bad actor in the world right now. And, you know, I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. But, you know, this whole thing that, you know, Trudeau's cozying up to China and all these socialists, and he had his picture taken with someone who's a communist, which was a real meme that they were doing last week. And that's just American red baiting, you know, the whole socialist talk that Trump is grasping at in order to try to tar Biden with the brush of well, what is laughingly called the American socialists, you know, which we would call probably centrist liberals, maybe left liberals here in Canada, not even NDP. You see that affecting Canadian politics in importing some of the louder, brasher, more obnoxious aspects of the last 4 years of American politics. And that's just a factor of listening to this stuff every day on the news.
Yeah, it's, I think that aside from the effects, legislative effects, that a friendly or a non-friendly U.S. administration can have on Canada, the effects of the campaigning have really affected us. And the effects of, and I think that Trump's entire term has been constant campaign mode. And so that's affected us, because we see here conservatives, there used to be conservatives in Canada who were not what you would recognize as conservatives if you were coming from the United States. They're for social programs, they're for various social supports and social initiatives that American conservatives were dead set against. There were some similarities, but very, very few. And their comportment was not what U.S. conservatives had been. They were not the, you know, of the dick swinging variety. And we have seen now that changed, the tenor of that changed when the Conservative Party was taken over by the Reform Party, which has its own form of Western alienation populism. But over the past few years, since Trump's been in office, I have noticed voices who identify themselves as conservative on social media parroting what has been said by conservatives in the United States. We're seeing the same messages. We're seeing, it reminds me of many years ago, I ran for school trustee.
Must have been a few years ago.
It was quite a few years ago, 1991, actually, 91 or 92. And there were particular issues in the district I was running in, North York. And a person I knew decided that he thought that he would run for school trustee as well, except he lived north of North York. He lived in a completely different jurisdiction, and his literature copied my literature, including the issues that were being highlighted, except that they were not the same issues there. And so he was, you know, he was laughed out of all candidates' meetings because his literature was completely out of step with what was going on, the realities of the Thornhill area. But this reminds me of that in the sense of, we've got conservative voices here going on about immigration, going on about gay rights, going on about and baiting people who are liberals. The whole liberalism is a mental disorder situation, that's a hashtag that spreads from time to time. That is an import from the United States. That is not something that really grew from our body politic. it's something that came through the, you know, semi-permeable membrane of our border with the United States, because that's just not in the spirit of the political discourse that Canada had for the majority of its time as a country since Confederation. And so the meanness, the nastiness, the viciousness, the pettiness that we see in U.S. politics, in the U.S. culture war, has made its way here, and it increases during election time, as there's people here who, I truly believe that a lot of the people who say they identify with Trump do so because they like the Trump, they like who Trump makes angry. They like seeing liberals angry. It makes them amused to see liberals angry. So they support Trump because of who he makes angry. I don't know that they even have given much thought to the policies and the impact of those policies. They just like seeing certain people scream. But we nonetheless have an increased tide in, I will call them right wing, not even conservative, though conservative are to the right of center. I don't consider every conservative to be right wing, just as I don't consider everybody who is left of center to be left wing, because you can be moderate. And I don't think we should tar them with those brushes. But certainly on the right wing of Canadian politics, I mean, just look at Maxime Bernier, who didn't get any support in the last election, but there he was with his loudspeaker, and he attracted people. Now, not a sizable enough people to make an electoral impact, but sizable enough that he formed a party that had a reach across the country. It had candidates across the country. So, and that hit, what he was spewing was purely regurgitated American conservatism. So the campaign itself, never mind the election of the president, does affect how we frame our issues here in Canada, even though, as you pointed out, our politics are completely different.
Yeah, and it's important to see, you know, there are a couple of major differences. I mean, I think one of the good things about being across the border from the United States and seeing the dumpster fire that's going on there, and whether they in 3 weeks from now, whether or not they put it out or they decide they want 4 more years of it is yet to be seen. But one of the positive things, I think, is Canada has always been a country that defines itself in contrast to the United States. A lot of the Canadian identity is positive, but it's also a negative one in the sense that it defines itself by what it's not. And the United States has put into really stark relief what we are not, or at least what we'd like to think that we are not. So you're looking at the kind of politics that goes on. I'm looking at the Supreme Court nomination going on in the States right now, Amy Coney Barrett, and the circus that has just started over her, as she seems to be determined not to answer any questions at all about her stance on anything. But the Canadian system also is an appointment system. You know, our judges are appointed by the government of the day. They're appointed for life, and they're appointed for life for good reason. What it does is it gives judges independence of the from any political influence. The thing about our judges is once you're appointed, they lose all politics. In the United States, you know, you see judges who are clearly branded Republican or Democrat, and they're proud to be that way, and they're elected as a Democrat or a Republican. And you assume that they bring a certain viewpoint with them because of their party affiliation. They also campaign, they fundraise, they endorse people. And in Canada, judges are absolutely politically neutered. They are not allowed to, they're generally not even allowed to have a candidate sign on their lawn. That would be considered a breach of their impartiality. They're not allowed to participate in politics or endorse candidates or do any of that sort of stuff. But in the United States, it's the exact opposite. It is a circus, and it's crazy, you know, speaking just as a Canadian lawyer, to go through the Supreme Court justice and say, well, they're Republicans, so they're going to vote this way, and we need votes on this issue, so we need a Democrat. In Canada, they get appointed, and all of a sudden, something magical happens to them. They lose all political prejudices. I mean, they're human beings, so, you know, they don't lose all of them, but the way they act is pretty much pretty much completely divorced from whatever political life or whatever party, whatever government appointed them. And you saw this with Harper. You know, Harper appointed, I think, 6 or 7 out of the 9 Supreme Court justices in Canada by the time his terms were over. And it's very, very hard to see the Supreme Court turning around on any major issue during that time. And as a matter of fact, the Supreme Court, including the people he appointed, ruled against him numerous times because legislation that they brought in, whether it was mandatory minimum sentences or the death with dignity provisions, those were his judges who voted against government policy. So they didn't feel beholden to the government. They didn't feel like they were agents or an arm of the government. They are an independent and equal branch of government. Whereas in the United States, watching what's going on at the Supreme Court, it is a pure partisan shit show. And you wonder how there is going to be any kind of going forward, especially since some of the people that have been appointed by Trump and his group of reactionaries to do a job, you know, how the next 30 years of American judicial life is going to look, because stuff that ends up at the Supreme Court is going to be tainted by politics.
Well, it kind of always has been, because when you, in the United States, unlike here, you appoint people for their political views. Here, as you pointed out, we appoint them, and yes, they tend to be people who come from a certain political fraternity, so to speak, but they rule based on the law. They don't, their votes aren't guaranteed. Now they're in the US, the Supreme Court, they know certain judges like Clarence Thomas, they know that anytime a Republican comes before them, the Republican is going to get a vote from Clarence Thomas that is favorable to the Republican, because Clarence Thomas is a Republican. We have situations in the US where they actually elect judges. And I can't think of a, to use a Trump term, more monstrous way of adjudicating laws than electing people and subjecting the judicial process to a popularity contest, to mob rule, because that's essentially what it is. I think there's probably plenty of miscarriages of justice in the United States that have been fueled by somebody trying to get elected or get reelected, as opposed to their consideration of the actual particulars of the law. And I mean, we stand in such stark difference to the United States with regards to judicial independence. And I, perhaps I'm biased, but I think our system works better. Our laws are primary here, and interpretation of laws and precedent and so on, that's primary, as opposed to party stripes being primary. And in the US, they're pretty much party stripes that are primary, and the partisans find legal arguments to back up exactly what their political persuasion wants them to rule like.
Or pandering to the public too, because, you know, the United States, as you said, the United States, and Stephen Colbert did a famous, I'm sorry, it wasn't Stephen Colbert, it was John Oliver did a famous piece, if you Google it on YouTube, about elected judges and why it's such a terrible idea, and how there's only two countries in the world that do it, and it's like the United States and Uruguay. But, you know, judges, to get elected, pander to the public. And instead of being devoted to principles of fairness and justice and compassion and mercy and rehabilitation, they appeal to good old-fashioned American vengeance, and they will campaign on the fact that, you know, they've put so many people on death row, or that, you know, they're known as the hanging judge, or, and it's basically, you know, putting mob rule back into justice, which, you know, and no justice system is perfect. But it really is going back to the American frontier. And again, you know, that is such a stark contrast to, you know, my personal experiences through the judicial system and seeing judges who weigh, you know, completely unrelated to any outside influences of what are the voters going to think about me next time I come around? What is the party that appointed me going to think about? Am I going to get a job when I'm done all of this kind of thing? When I, you know, I stop being a judge and I go to retirement, you know, how am I going to be viewed and how am I going to make money? You know, those sorts of things are all taken off the table in Canada. And so judges can concentrate on what is the law, what is fair, you know, how is justice best served, as opposed to, oh, I've got all these interest groups that are pulling me in all kinds of different directions to get me, you know, that that may drag me in directions that are other than justice and fairness.
Yeah, I getting back to, I guess, our question of how the U.S. Election will affect us. Do you believe that a Joe Biden presidency will be markedly different in its way that it deals with Canada than the Trump presidency has been?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure the United States thinks about us that much. I posted something on Twitter the other day, which has become very popular because it's so passively aggressively Canadian. It's somebody holding up a sign at a Trump rally saying Trump will protect us from Canada.
Yes, with the barbed wire wall, with the barbed wire on the wall.
Yeah. And, you know, the world's largest undefended border. And, you know, it made all, I've had so many Canadians kind of, you know, all these wry, you know, jokes about it, because mostly the United States doesn't even think about us at the best of times. And that's a good thing, because, you know, you don't want the Americans thinking about you too much, because bad things happen when they do.
Yeah, you want to stay off their radar.
Yeah, it's like, no, you know, it's like Al Capone said, Canada, I don't even know what street it's on.
Yeah.
And we are their largest trading partner and, you know, an important source of everything from raw materials, from timber and mining, right, materials. And we've sort of shrunk in their view, because at one point we were very much a branch plant of the American economy. A lot of corporations had their headquarters here. Some of them still do, but with globalization, they don't have to be in Canada anymore. And they've actually taken a lot of our manufacturing, industrial, and branch plant business away from us and moved it to Mexico or to Southeast Asia or wherever they can do it cheaper. So we're not really being considered that much. I mean, when it comes to trade, I think the one thing Canada is going to benefit from is having adults at the table and having some consistency, because we like consistency. We like to know how the next couple of weeks are going to unfold and whether we're going to be slapped with a new aluminum tariff just out of the blue because someone watched something on Fox News about how the United States is being taken advantage of terribly by these Canadian aluminum magnates, and you know, and decides they're going to announce a tariff on Canadian aluminum or softwood lumber or shakes and shingles or fish or whatever it is this week. I think a Biden administration will be run by adults. It'll be a lot more stable. I think that'll be good for Canadian planning and future cooperation as well. But, you know, the reality is, even though we supply the United States with an awful lot of stuff, we are kind of, in the last 4 years, been decoupling a bit from the United States simply because of the capriciousness of the Trump government. And you saw the Trudeau government going out and making bilateral agreements, whether it was in Southeast Asia or with the EU or with other countries, because we realize that putting all of our eggs in the American basket is not a good thing, because when things go nuts down there, we're at risk.
Now, what do you think the benefit of stability in the United States is to Canada, in the way that it stabilizes situations in the world? How does that accrue benefit to us?
Well, I think a stable world accrues benefit to everybody. You know, American military adventurism, I think, is probably going to continue to shrink. I mean, Trump is doing it, but not for the right reasons. You know, Trump doesn't like, he doesn't like any of the wars that Obama was involved in. And, you know, he's cozied up to some of the bad actors in the world as well. And so he doesn't want to challenge them on their home turf. So, you know, with everything from Turkey to China, even though he talks a tough game with China, you know, he's really withdrawn America from a lot of world events. I mean, at one point he was talking about withdrawing from NATO and withdrawing from the United Nations and becoming its own hermit nation again. But you know, America not being present in the world, it it's a change. It's a real change in geopolitics, because geopolitics abhors a vacuum, and who's going to step into it? I mean, Russia doesn't have the, you know, it doesn't have the money, it doesn't have the manpower, it doesn't have the clout that it once did. I mean, as a nuclear nation on the other side of the table from the United States, you know, there was sort of a balance there. Although I think it was more fictional, because, you know, the Soviet Union was crumbling, and Russia isn't much better. China is the only other big boy on the block, and I don't think the world wants a world dominated by China. They've got their grips on Africa, Southeast Asia, and a whole bunch of other places. They'd love to get their technology into North American markets too, but they haven't been too successful doing that. So the United States it's going to take a while for them to climb back into a position of world authority, because militarily they've pulled back, whether it's in Afghanistan or in the Middle East. They don't want to spend money on commitments. At least Trump has said that. I don't see Biden being much of a warmonger, or being he's not coming to power riding on a crest of militarism, military glory. He doesn't want to have
that. He doesn't project that.
No,
he doesn't want to speak about it.
I mean, he likes the support of generals who just say, boy, you know, there's no adults in charge anymore. But that, yeah. I don't see that as support of militarism. I see that as a support of there has to be adult leadership somewhere, especially, for the people who've got their fingers on the nuclear button. But it's not a militaristic thing. And economically, the United States has been, through policies since Reagan, been crippling itself. As people like to point out, the stock market is not the economy. It is for, the 1% of the population that invests in the stock market to a substantial amount. But Americans have become poor. I mean, they've become sicker. They've become, more insular. They've really, is the sun setting on the American empire? I mean, it certainly is not the robust force that it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And even the 80s, but I'm not sure that that's the kind of thing that Biden is going to turn around. I mean, I think he's got so much patching of the canoe, to use a Canadian metaphor, that he's going to have to do for the next little while. I mean, it's sort of like when Justin Trudeau took over from Harper. I mean, there's so many things that needed reinstating and fixing that were intentionally broken by the previous government, that it's really hard to get new ideas on the agenda because, you're busy fixing stuff. I think Biden is going to find himself in much the same situation. And that doesn't give you a lot of room for American swagger in the world.
As you pointed out, the capriciousness of the U.S. and, the mercurial nature of the Trump presidency did teach us that we need to start forging other alliances. In that respect, I think that it was good for us, in that it shook us out of complacency, and it allowed us to go searching. It forced us to realize we need to strengthen our interaction with markets around the world. We can't simply rely on the United States just because it's easy, because we share geography with them. And so necessity has forced us to broaden our view of trading partners, and I think that's been a good thing. The fact of the matter is that no country will ever replace the United States, because we share geography, because we share certain cultural touchstones, we share fashions, we share consumer products. Our lifestyles are similar to the extent that we do have similar durable goods, cars made by the same people. Yep. It's that there's so much commonality. As much as we've been diverging from the U.S. on a social spectrum, we remain very aligned with them on a number of areas where we've got commonality. And so the U.S. can't really do without Canada, and Canada can't do without the U.S. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of Biden's first trips as president would be to Canada to try to patch up the trouble that Biden caused, though our attitude has pretty much been, sort of brushing our shoulder off every time Trump does something. I mean, we chased off their last round of tariffs. We stood up to them. We did a good job with the NAFTA too, in securing things for our country. We had to give things up, but that's a basis of a negotiation. But we did well in standing our ground on numerous numerous fronts. And so when we've actually come up and clashed with the U.S. administration the last 4 years, we've actually done fairly well, especially compared to how others have fared when clashing with the Trump administration. So I don't know that there's any ill will or any need to improve that relationship. I think that the Canadian body politic recognizes that Trump is an aberration. And, you know, for all we know, he could get elected again, in which case the aberration will become the norm. And we'll see Trump type candidates, you know, down the road. And for all we know, Trump gets a second term, he'll push to make it possible for him to have a third. But yeah, barring that, having a Biden presidency and having that stability will allow us to have negotiations and discussions with our trading partner where we feel there's some permanence and some reliability to the product of those, you know, the outcome of those negotiations and those talks.
Yeah, and I think it tells volumes that, you know, you look at the Trump ambassador to Canada, Kelly Craft. She really didn't want to be in Canada. I mean, she dragged her heels about coming here. I mean, it was an appointment, but it was more of an honor than anything else. She wasn't here as a working ambassador. And, you know, she was, you know, she's the wife of Joe Craft, who's a billionaire coal mining executive who was, you know, the third largest coal producer in the United States. Trump was famously pro-coal, and she was an enormous donor to Trump, which is how she got the gig. But again, you know, she was basically, the joke in Ottawa was, she was an absentee ambassador. No one ever found her. She was never in Canada. And, you know, at the moment, we don't even have, the United States does not even have a full ambassador to Canada. There's an acting ambassador by the name of Richard Mills, and he's been acting ambassador since August. But the United States has never bothered to appoint an ambassador to Canada. It's, you know, its neighbor and biggest trading partner, and that tells you just how much neglect there is built into the system when they look at us. And I think, you know, I think Canada would be looking forward to a better relationship with the United States, starting with, maybe appointing a decent person as an actual ambassador to this country.
That would certainly be a move in the right direction. They take us for granted and they kick us around when they feel the need. And I don't think that a Biden administration would do quite the same thing. But, you know, like Americans, we're going to have to wait and see what the outcome is in a few weeks. And if there is an outcome in a few weeks, that's in and of itself something else. That it's interesting that the news leaked last week that the Trudeau government is preparing for all contingencies as a result of the U.S. election. So this notion that there won't be a orderly transfer of power is obviously more than just some propaganda stirred up against Trump. I mean, his comments, his and Pence's comments, or lack of response to certain questions, indicates that they're not quite willing to say that if they lose, they will turn over power peacefully. And the fact that we have our own government preparing for that contingency, for all we know, they prepared for it in the past, but I think that's unlikely, because I think this whole discussion was not something that happened in the past. It wasn't even something that was considered. So interesting that our government's preparing for that. One thing I did want to talk about, and it just briefly, and it happened a few weeks ago, but every time I think about bringing it up, we talk about other things. And that is the sort of assailant that Jagmeet Singh had when he was out on a walk a few weeks ago.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, well, again, this is an American import. This is a, you know, the guy who wants to make, he was also grabbed at outside of Trudeau's residence. He went onto the grounds of Rideau Hall, where the Rideau Cottages, where the Prime Minister is staying with his family, and they hug tied him there too. So I'm sorry, but I stepped on, you know, it's a guy who wants to make citizen arrests of Trudeau and of Jagmeet Singh. I'm not entirely sure why, but, you know, it's always important not to try to understand a crazy person too well, because, you know, they kind of suck you into their delusion. Yeah, that is a strange, strange story of a guy who just, harasses and tries to get close to politicians and threatens them with citizens' arrests.
Yeah, and
which succeeds. Isn't a thing, by the way. It's not a thing.
we don't have those things here in Canada, do we?
Well, a citizen can detain somebody who's in the commission of a crime. If someone's breaking into your house, you can sit on them until the cops arrive. That's basically a citizen's arrest. Or, if you see someone, drunk driving and they fall out of their car, you can hold them until the police arrive. And that's technically a citizen's arrest. But no, the way this guy is talking about it, I mean, he wants to bring them in front of the world court or some shadow organization of brothers who are going to, much like the governor of Michigan, with the white supremacists who are going to arrest her in the name of the people and try her for treason. I mean, it's the same kind of crazy idea.
I note that one thing we don't know about those individuals who were planning to kidnap the governor of Michigan is how many of them make their own sausages. At least when there's somebody trying to take down one of our political leaders, we at least make note of their food choices. But facetiousness aside, I was struck by Jagmeet Singh's response to that, his saying, "Oh, I wasn't bothered. Other people might be bothered, but I wasn't bothered." And I thought, what an ass. Like, what kind of stupid bravado is that? Would it take much for him to, because I'm sorry, anybody who encounters that, I don't care if you've got martial arts training or not, you don't know what kind of weapon this person may have with them. And also, crazy can get real strong and real wily. Anybody in that situation would have been a little spooked, no matter what. And this nonsensical response of his that, well, other people might have been freaked out, but I'm what didn't bother me. I just thought that was an indication, a way into his character and to the way he likes to present himself to the public in a way that is just not realistic. And there's a pompousness there that I guess I'm not terribly surprised, but just the way that swagger, it bothered me. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And it's hard to know how you're going to react in a situation like that. I mean, it put me in mind, when I, like a million years ago, when I was in my 20s, I worked in Ottawa. I worked on the Hill as an assistant to a cabinet minister. And I remember walking along Wellington Street in front of the Parliament buildings. I was going from some meeting to another, thinking I was pretty special. I was wearing like a little three-piece suit and was carrying my briefcase. And I was going from some meeting that they'd let me go to another one. And somebody came up and started harassing me in much sort of the same way. And I'm like, I'm 22 years old or something. And I guess I just looked a little too buttoned down. And like I had, even though I always had a baby face, that, I must be someone. And this guy started yelling at me. And I remember him kind of, spit flying all over the place. And it's kind of frightening being confronted with that kind of irrationality. And was I going to tackle the guy? No. I mean, my first instinct was, just RCMP all over the place, find a Mountie who's posing for a picture and point the guy out. But, this sort of thing is starting to creep into Canadian life. And it really has to be slapped down. I don't think being cavalier about it is the way to go. I mean, it's great to be self-confident and knowing, I know karate and I could put the guy down. But, there's a bigger question here, which is, who is he going to harass next? And in fact, this guy actually went on and harassed another person. It was someone who he thought was a member of parliament, and it turned out to be a reporter, I think, for the Ottawa Citizen or something. No, Radio Canada. It was a Radio Canada reporter, Daniel Thibodeau, and was, he was trying to make a citizen's arrest of a Radio Canada reporter. It's like, well, I'm not sure those charges are going to stick.
Yeah, the cavalier attitude also bothered me because this is something that we're starting to see creeping into our politics. We're starting to see extremists trying to get close to, and succeeding in some cases, getting close to our politicians with ill intent. And we should be taking this seriously. There, we shouldn't be responding with bravado. We should be taking seriously how close, I mean, why there is no RCMP protection for Jagmeet Singh, I don't know. I understand he's not the government or leader of the opposition, but he's the leader of a sizable party and he's a sizable public figure. And I really think that in the world we're living in, I don't want it to be a tragedy that wakes us up to the notion that nowadays we really need to protect our political leaders because crazies are emboldened. And just because it hasn't happened in Canada yet doesn't mean it won't. And you know what? If the RCMP had somehow made a misstep with the sausage maker who wanted to have a conversation with the prime minister at gunpoint, who knows what would have happened? And this stuff, you know, we've had near misses. And so we're not instituting the kind of changes that need to be instituted. After the sausage maker incident, all party leaders who have a certain following, and certainly the NDP has a following, and there is considerable backlash against them because of where they sit on the political spectrum, and the backlash against them is by people who on the political spectrum who have been the ones who perpetrated violence in the United States based on political motivations. We really should have been providing RCMP protection for Jagmeet Singh, and Jagmeet Singh should not be glancing this off like it was nothing. He should have been using this as an example of, look, we're living in a more dangerous world for politicians and we need to have proper protections. And that's not being a wuss. That's just being realistic. No job should carry with it the danger of physical harm.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And again, this is one of the sad imports from the United States. I mean, the rhetoric, we've seen Pierre Poilievre and O'Toole have been ramping up the rhetoric about corruption and about Trudeau being a dupe of the Chinese and the Chinese communists, and the people, the guy who has been doing these attempted citizens arrests, he's part of a protest that's basically created a tent city at the National War Memorial. I mean, it's sort of the yellow vesters that we saw a year or two ago, and they've sort of disappeared. But they don't never really disappear. They just sort of reform themselves. So these people, and if you just look at some of the posters that they have hung up around their tent city, and it's all the crazy stuff. I mean, it's about attempted to seize unlimited spending power and cause debt slavery, selling our defense satellites to the Communist Party of China. It's all about these strange Agenda 21, United Nation, One World Order, reptile aliens who live in saucer ships kind of stuff. That you really have to sit on. I'm a big free speecher as well, but when you're going up and threatening harm to politicians, it only takes a second for that to go bad and have the wrong person do it. I do remember, I'll tell you an anecdote. I remember Pierre Trudeau. When Pierre Trudeau was on his book tour, he did his memoirs in 84, 85, somewhere around there. I remember being at an event at the waterfront Hilton, I guess it was, in Toronto, and he was signing books. And it was a fairly controlled event, but not so controlled that you couldn't get in. It was there were a number of people there, and Trudeau was going down the aisle, shaking hands with a lot of well wishers, and somebody came out of the crowd, and started screaming about him being a traitor or something, and then made a mistake of putting grabbing him by the lapel. And I was across the aisle, and so I actually watched this myself. Pierre Trudeau kind of did a half jump in the air, planted a foot on the guy's chest, and kicked him backwards into a wall. And that was it. And it wasn't, it seemed pretty instinctive, and Pierre Trudeau was getting pretty, he was getting on at that point. I mean, he was in his late 60s, probably, maybe early 70s. He was a karate guy himself. But you can't count on politicians all having a black belt and being able to defend themselves or having to defend themselves, because we live in a civil society and there's room for disagreement, and the constant stirring of the pot and the whipping up of a frenzy by using all kinds of inflammatory language by both the right and the left is poisoning our discourse, and it's bringing out these crazies. And it's only a matter of time before there's a tragedy.
Yeah, and that's my point. It's only a matter of time until there's a tragedy. We've had, the sausage maker was a very serious threat and should have been a wake-up call. And apparently it was not a wake-up call. Somebody hit snooze and they're going back to waiting for something terrible to happen before they do something. And I don't think that's a great idea. And I don't think that Singh poo-pooing the whole situation was a responsible leadership position to take. But I think that brings us to the close of another one of our programs.
Yes. And who knows what next week is going to bring.
Yeah, that's may you live in interesting times. And
I shudder to think.
Yeah. Then the worst case scenario is that there's nothing for us to talk about. So there has to be something.
Guarantee there'll be something.
Okay, I'll take you up on that. All right.
Maybe even in Canada.
Yeah, there may be something here to talk about. Stephen, I want to thank you. You can reach Stephen on Twitter. You follow him at Stephen Lautens, StephenLautens. I'm at Stephen J. Kersner, StevenJKerzner. And I want to thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Stephen. This has always been, it's been a pleasure.
Hey, I love just chatting with you.
And that's pretty much all that we do, but people seem to enjoy what we have to say. And I appreciate you listening week after week and telling other people about it. And I appreciate your support. Whereas, as you know, we're asking for $5. Just give us $5 a month and we'll continue to give you this program and many other programs that I know many of you enjoy. And I know we're getting upwards of 60,000 listens a month. So you're out there. And if just a fraction of you give us $5 a month so that we can keep going and not just keep going, but grow. And you consider the potential is there for this to grow much bigger. And who knows what direction we could grow in, but we're still starting out. We're still a startup. And we need you guys to help us stay started. Is that even a thing? I don't know.
Sure, stay started.
Yes, stay operating.
It makes as much sense as build back better. We can talk about that another day.
But it's alliteration.
It is. So it's got to be good.
So it's got to be good. Alliteration is it rules. You can help us out at patreon.com/FUNetworkTV, or you can do it through PayPal. A lot of people seem to be enjoying the PayPal option, where you can go monthly with a recurring payment, or you can just give a one-time payment of however much you'd like to give. And at PayPal, you direct to our email address, funetworktv@gmail.com. All right, Stephen, that's our time.
It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to carrying on next week.
All right, and until then, I'm Stephen Kersner for Stephen Lautens. This has been Stephen and Stephen on Fun, the FU Network.